Bill 2403. I have two folks signed up for that. If you'd like to come to the front table and identify yourself for the record, I will have counsel explain the bill, and I'll remind the group today that the House floor session begins at 10:30, so we have an hour to get through with about four bills. I think that House Bill 2222, and talking to the proponents of that bill, they are requesting just a public hearing today because they have some events they'd like to discuss and bring back at a later time. So the proponents for 2403, anybody here? I have two people signed up.
Yeah, I'm going to go.
Yes. Counsel, can you explain the bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2403 is sponsored by Representative Lim. It requires the Department of Transportation to conduct a study on photo radar to determine whether the cities that are using photo radar to increase traffic safety or to generate revenue. House Bill 2403 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Gentlemen, whomever wishes to go first may state his name for the record.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Rogers, and I am the Deputy Chief of Staff for Representative John Lim. Unfortunately, the representative couldn't be here because he's in a committee meeting, and what he had sent me here to do basically is to give his views on what this bill means to him and to take any notes back to him and to respond with his answers to the committee. What the representative's idea on this bill is wanted to know exactly how photo radar is exactly helping the speed on our Oregon's highways. It is his contention that we need to study this to find out if it's working in some areas, if it's not working in other areas, and what exactly those areas that are working, how they're doing it, and making it work for them. That's about all I have, so any questions?
Thank you. Questions of the witness from the committee? Seeing none, we'll proceed to the next witness, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And House Bill 2403, as written, the responsibility for this particular study would fall into my office for reporting back to the next legislative assembly. As the bill is written, one I would like to note is that Oregon's had photo radar since 1995. And in past history, in the 1995 bill, Senate Bill 382, that initially authorized Beaverton and Portland to run photo radar programs. And with that, gave the Department of Transportation responsibility for filing a report with the legislative body in 1997, which was done. During 1997, Senate Bill 651 made photo radar permanent, no longer a pilot study for 2 years, and then at that point in time, deleted the reporting requirements by the Department of Transportation on the local cities running photo radar. During the 1999 legislature, House Bill 3085 added the cities of Albany, Bend, Eugene, Medford, and Tigard to the photo radar program as they are listed specifically in statute. Those are the only 7 cities allowed to run photo radar. There were no changes in the 01 or 03 legislative session, and since that time there's also been no reporting by the department because that requirement was removed from statute in the late 1990s. Photo radar has been used worldwide, and there are some countries such as France and others that have really ramped up their program in order to make a difference and have studies that show that it makes a difference. And in Oregon, the cities that are running it have done studies and shown that it makes a difference as well. One of the common questions about photo radar is what happens to the money. A traffic citation issued under the photo radar program, the fines and fees paid, follow the process just like any other traffic ticket does, with the majority of those funds actually ending up in the state's general fund. The report, as requested in the particular bill, we feel has a requirement for us to do a look at photo radar in general and then some specifics about the 7 cities that are authorized to operate. would also alert you that there is at least one bill, if not more, coming, other cities that are wanting to operate photo radar in the state that would be coming before you during this legislative session. House Bill 2403 would require the cities to report to us, and then in turn, the department to you at the next legislative assembly. And would like to say just unequivocally, photo radar has worked in this state and has made a difference and has actually successfully gone through a challenge all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court that has ruled in favor of photo radar and the process that it's currently working. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
Fine. We'll take your invitation. Questions, Representative Girard.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Who pays for the photo radar itself, the city or ODOT?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, the photo radar systems are put in place at the city's cost themselves. The department does not pay anything towards the photo radar program or the equipment.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Further questions of the witness? Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Costales, thank you very much for the background information. I understand that photo radar is not only an issue in Oregon, but across the country. Have you reviewed any studies about the other national concerns about the use of photo radar?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, good morning. We have looked at studies relating to photo radar for other cities and other jurisdictions, and if you, you know, do an internet search on under photo radar, you'll come up with a list that are pro and con, and generally on the negative side is the impression of Big Brother watching us all the time, don't have the right to do that. On the pro side, jurisdiction after jurisdiction talks about how it does make a difference, particularly in those high-speed areas around school zones or neighborhoods that have a speeding problem. There are different ways across the U.S. that photo radar citations are issued. There are some states where it does not go on the driving record, and it's like treated like a parking ticket would be, where an individual would be responsible for it, or it's issued to the owner of the vehicle, and you don't go through the rigors of figuring out who the driver is. In this state, the legislation and the policy statement is it's going to go to the driver, and there's going to be work done on figuring out who the driver is, not just to the owner of the vehicle. And from a safety point of view, we have not found a study out there that says that it is unsafe or unwarranted. There are challenges at various state legislative bodies to talk about, for the most part, the Big Brother looking in, watching me type of approach, not generally from a safety point of view.
Follow up.
Thank you, Janae.
Thank you. You mentioned the citation that would go to the driver, and I understand that piece is also subject to controversy in regard determining the driver and or citing the presumptive driver or getting information on the actual driver. Is that something that you are continuing to deal with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, that was in part what the Oregon Supreme Court case was all about a few years ago, which was talking about the individual having to talk about who they turned in and to the particular city in relationship to who the driver was of that particular vehicle at the time. And it has lived up to and was approved by the Supreme Court. There is and was earlier this session already some conversation around the red light running process in a Senate bill and a Senate hearing. And the individual legislator that's interested in that and the city under question are continuing their conversations.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Costales, how does the cost of operating photo radar compare with the cost of having a uniformed officer in a car holding a radar gun?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative McPherson, good morning. The cost of operating photo radar is less expensive and less risky to the officers that are on the street due to their ability to be in one place and take photo and citation and travel and speed information and can issue more citations in a particular period of time than a uniformed officer would be on the side of the street. However, there are limits in statute in relationship to how long they can be in a particular place at one time, no more than 4 hours. And they are required to have signage in front and around the particular photo radar device so that individuals know they're entering into an area where photo radar would be used on that particular street. From a cost point of view, it depends on also the officer you have in the van operating it. Currently, you have to have a sworn officer that's in the van with the unit. and I guess that person's per hour charge is there, but they are able to issue more citations in a particular given time if they were out on the road on a motorcycle or a police car.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fine, thank you. Further questions, Representative Girard?
I just wanted to make sure that I'm right here. You said the money that's accrued from the fines goes into the city's general fund?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Girard, fines from the photo radar citation are just like any other ticket. There are some monies that stay with the local court or the local agency, some monies that are transferred to the Department of Public Service Safety and Training, to the Police Academy, and the overwhelming chunk of it is what goes into the state's general fund.
The state general fund.
That is correct, sir.
Okay. Yes, follow up.
Could you give me just an idea of what percentage winds up in the state's general fund?
Mr. Chair, give me just a second. I'll see if I can get an exact percentage for you.
Fine.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Girard, I'd like to get more specifics for you later, but in general, based on percentages and different fines and fees that are out there, it's somewhere between 30 and 40% of the fine will end up in the state's general fund. But if you'd like, I would ask for some time to get back to you on a little bit of the breakdown, if you'd like, as to where a traffic fine generally flows and what percentages go where.
Yes, I'd like that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Further questions for the committee?
Mr. Chair,
Flores,
I would just
you have that look.
Thank you. You're getting to read that, aren't you?
Yeah.
Thank you. I would just request that information be made available to the committee administrator for the rest of the members as well.
Fine. That's understood. Okay. Further questions of the witnesses from the committee? If not, thank you for your testimony, and I'll conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2403. And Mr. Rogers, you'll be here for House Bill 2423. Why don't you just resume your seat, and I recognize that you're here for Representative Lynn. We'll just extend to you the privileges we went to him, and let you start as I open the public hearing on House Bill 2423.
Good morning once again. For the record, my name is Bill Rogers, and I am Deputy Chief of Staff for Representative John Lim. House Bill 2423 is a bill that the representative had introduced that his contention is to have background checks done on all employees of hospital and service providers of hospital services. His idea on behind all this is to make sure that we have due diligence, that we do not have people that should not be licensed working in hospitals. I have been in contact with several agencies in this, and from what I've been gathering from information is that majority of them already do their own background checks. What the representative would like to make sure that all of them have them done, writing from all the way from the janitors all the way up to the top persons in the hospital areas. What he wants to do is that this is not to be carved in stone. He is more than willing to work with everyone on this to try to find out the best possible way to do this and most cost effective.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Rogers from the committee? Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rogers, it looks to me like this bill would apply to any employment with a hospital, regardless of whether the individual had any direct patient contact or was engaged in clinical care. Am I reading it correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, this is correct.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And is it the belief behind the bill that those positions in the hospital that don't have any direct patient contact, that those pose a safety threat if somebody who had been convicted of a sex crime were working in those positions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, this is correct. Anybody that's working in the hospital does have access, even though technically they do or they do not. They are licensed to be on the premises, so therefore they can get where they're not supposed to be, if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
questions? Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me an idea of the precedent or for putting in the prohibition for anyone who's ever been convicted of sex crime for ever working at the hospital if it hopes to be licensed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I'm not really able to do those kind of things. The representative just wanted me to bring out the basics of what he wants. That question, I think, would best be answered by him.
You may.
Can you at least give me an idea if I've got this correctly, that this would bar or prohibit anyone ever convicted of a sex crime? Say hypothetically, a 15-year-old under Measure 11 is convicted and serves 7 years, then goes on to get a nursing degree or a medical degree, then he or she would be prohibited from working in a hospital that hopes to be licensed in the state of Oregon, and therefore taking the discretionary decision-making away from the hospital.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, then again, I'd have to refer that back to Representative Lim on his ideas on that.
Okay.
But I know he had expressed to me that he is more than willing to work and to put amendments in if possible. I'm not sure that that's, you know, how he would characterize it, but then again, I'm not at liberty to really say.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions? I just have a couple of observations, Mr. Rogers, and also for the benefit of the others that will testify this morning. I had three basic criticisms of the bill that I think would need clarification. First, picking up on Representative McPherson's point as to how broadly you cast the net on people that are contracting with the hospital. My second point would be that which Representative Worth has brought up. You state run checks on people convicted of crimes, but would probably not include a minor person that was convicted of a crime as a minor. It's just a technicality, but I think it's something we have to look at. And then my other criticism is on page 5 on the last page in the boldface where it says a license will not be issued or renewed for any hospital as defined in ORS 442.015. When you look at that section, there's about 34 subsections, and it's conceivable that when you're talking about hospital services, you're going to pick up long-term care facilities and HMOs and everything else. So I don't know if you're going to define it specifically to a hospital, then you'd have to put in subsection 19 to clarify that. And so I'm just bringing these things up because I know we have other people that might want to talk to these points this morning, but for your benefit and representative's benefit, you should know the issues that we have. I think these could be potentially cured by amendments, but it looks like that's where we're going to have to go after today.
Mr. Chairman, okay. that's exactly...
Yes, any questions you may have or comments?
Mr. Chairman, that's what Representative Lim wanted me to get across, is that this is not cast in stone. He wants to be very flexible on this. This was kind of a broad idea so that this can be brought up for discussion.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Thank you for your testimony. I'll call. We have three witnesses signed up. Ms. Carroll, Ms. Smale, and Bruce Bishop. We have three chairs. We have three witnesses. You may decide for yourself for whom will testify first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Georgina Carroll, and I'm the manager of the Criminal Records Unit for the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to present some information on the requirements and the impact of House Bill 2423. With me is Kathleen Schmale, representing the Office of Public Health Systems, and she'll speak to the impact of the bill on licensing of hospitals. House Bill 2423 amends ORS 181-537, which is the statute regarding conducting criminal history checks by the Department of Human Services. The department currently does background checks on its employees, volunteers, and providers of services for our clients. Section 1 of the bill adds hospital employees and all contractors who provide hospital services as individuals subject to a criminal history check. As you heard earlier, contractors are not defined in the bill, so we were uncertain as to the scope of who would be included. All contractors who do business with the hospital, such as food service, laundry, maintenance, construction workers working on the grounds, or does it mean only contractors who have access to patients or patient service? Section 2, subsection 9, prohibits DHS from licensing hospitals unless the applicant conducted a criminal records check. Here it appears that applicant means that the hospital would be the one required to do the criminal history check. However, in the last line of the subsection, it requires that the criminal records check be conducted in accordance with the rules under ORS 181-537, which is the DHS rule. And this appears to require the department to conduct the criminal history checks. Hospitals cannot conduct the record checks on their own and still meet the requirements of ORS 181-537. Hospitals cannot be an authorized agency to access criminal offender information from Oregon State Police. If the department's required to do the criminal history checks, there will be a substantial workload impact. DHS does not have the capacity to handle this increased volume of background checks within current staffing. Based on a quick estimate of hospital employees and contractors, there would be approximately 100,000 individuals initially to be checked. DHS currently processes about 15,000 subject individuals a month with a staff of about 40. To meet this additional workload, the department would need to increase staff. There are also processing costs for submitting a request for state and national criminal history information from the department, from the Oregon State Police and from FBI. Oregon State Police is in the process of increasing their fees, and the impact of that would also need to be factored into the cost of doing this work. The burden of the cost impact of House Bill 2343, however, will fall on the hospitals because DHS would assess a fee for the service to do the criminal history checks, which is allowed under ORS 181-537. DHS would charge the hospital a reasonable fee to cover the DHS administrative and processing costs and the Oregon State Police fees for each check. The actual fee amount is not yet determined, but we did a quick estimate, and we believe it would be around $20 per subject individual. In addition, hospitals would need to have designated staff trained and cleared to handle criminal history information, in order to meet the requirements of ORS 181-537. While the department fully supports the concept of protecting patients in Oregon hospitals, we have some concerns and questions about the scope of the bill and the way it's drafted. I'd be happy to answer questions, and we'd be happy to work with the committee further.
Let me take the next agency witness, and then I'll open up for questions, and we'll get to Mr. Bishop. Okay.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah.
My name is Kathleen Smale, and I'm the manager of healthcare licensure and certification in the Office of Public Health Systems. I'm testifying today to present information on House Bill 2423. Although the Department of Human Services fully supports efforts to protect Oregonians, regardless of what healthcare setting, and this includes hospital patients, from abuse in any form, this bill will have a significant fiscal impact on hospitals and may limit access to health care for Oregonians. The bill, if passed, would require hospitals to perform background checks on approximately 20,000 contractors, be they doctors, window washers, dietitians, as well as approximately 75 to 80,000 employees. The 61 hospitals in Oregon have more than 77,000 employees. At a cost of $20 per background check, fees paid by the hospitals for this purpose could exceed $1.5 million. For example, Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, with 4,300 employees, will be charged $86,000. This is for employees alone. Kaiser Sunnyside in Clackamas, with 1,500 employees, will be required to pay $30,500. Murrow West Hospital in Klamath Falls, with 1,000 employees, will be required to pay $20,000. And Lake District Hospital in Lakeview, with 139 employees, will be required to pay $2,780 for these background checks and fitness determinations. These figures do not include the cost of background checks for contractors, the annual charges for checks on new employees, or the annual salaries for hospital staff responsible for the screening and decision-making. Hospitals failing to comply with all of the bill's requirements would be denied licensure renewal by the Office of Public Health Systems, thereby reducing access to health care for Oregonians and eliminating health care jobs. In rural communities, many of these hospitals are the largest employer in town, and it's quite a distance to the next hospital. This situation would hit rural and smaller communities especially hard. In addition, the bill does not state how the department will determine a hospital's full compliance. In other words, has every employee's name been turned in? Has every contractor been reviewed? The department continues to be committed to protecting all Oregonians from abuse of any kind and to ensuring access to high-quality health care throughout the state. To that end, the staff in the Office of Public Health Systems thoroughly investigates every complaint received about hospitals, including those related to abuse. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or work with the committee further.
Fine. Thank you very much. Are there questions of the agency witnesses from the committee? I guess not. Thank you. Mr. Bishop?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. In general, the Hospital Association supports the need for hospitals to make sure that their employees are qualified and competent to provide services. One of the ways that this is accomplished is through criminal records checks. And in preparing this testimony, the Hospital Association surveyed Oregon hospitals. We received responses from virtually all hospitals, and they responded that they already conduct criminal record checks for new employees. Many also conduct checks on contracted providers. Some have extended those requirements to volunteers. Some have also included students who are working in their facilities. For these reasons, the Hospital Association supports what 2423 is attempting to accomplish. But we believe this legislation is unnecessary and will have undesirable consequences. Our most significant concerns arise with regard to Section 2, Subsection 9, which appears on page 5 of the bill. There are several problems with this provision. It amends the general licensing statute for healthcare facilities, and hospitals are one type of healthcare facility. And it says that licenses will not be issued or renewed unless criminal background checks have been conducted on all employees and contractors. If this is to be state policy, we see no reason that it should be limited to hospitals. We think that those requirements should be equally applicable to all healthcare facilities, and those are the facilities that are being licensed under Section 2. It's also not clear to us, as has been previously testified about, who those are who contract with the hospital. I believe that the language suggests that it's individuals and not entities. For example, health insurers contract with hospitals. I don't think the requirement is that criminal background checks be conducted on all employees or individuals in a health insurance organization, but the language isn't clear about who the contractors are and what the requirements would be. Should House Bill 2423 become law on January 1st of next year, we think it creates an untenable situation for hospitals. The law would become effective, and no license could be issued on that date or renewed unless there was an assurance that all of the criminal background checks had been conducted. at a minimum, if the committee intends to move this legislation, we would ask for some sort of reasonable transition period to be able to assure that all of the required checks have been done, and that the state has that information so that they can make their licensing determinations. Subsection 9 also requires that hospitals or applicants either conduct criminal records checks or initiate a national criminal records check if appropriate. It doesn't seem that the national record check is necessarily a substitute for the criminal record check, but I believe that that's the way the statute's drafted, and that provision should be clarified as well. The second sentence of subsection 9 prohibits hospitals from employing or contracting with persons convicted of certain sex crimes. And I've included in the testimony a list of those crimes that are referenced in ORS 181.594 sub 2. I'm reading that requirement as being an absolute ban on such persons being employed or contracting with hospitals. And it appears that the prohibition would apply immediately upon the law's taking effect. We question the justification for imposing that prohibition again only on one type of healthcare facility, and we don't believe that you've been presented with any evidence that suggests that there's a problem here in hospitals that warrants that sort of legislative action. I would also suggest that that provision may be outside of the bill's scope, which relates to criminal records checks. I think, as I read the provision, it is an absolute ban on employment and contracting and is not germane to the bill. Those are our principal concerns with regard to Section 2. Section 1 has some technical issues, and when we read both existing law and the current rules that are being considered by the Department of Human Services, it appears to us that hospitals may already fall within the definition of subject entities, and I suspect that that's probably the reason why hospitals are complying with the requirements and conducting criminal record checks already. In summary, we believe Section 1 of the bill is unnecessary, that Section 2 is unwarranted. We would urge the committee to take no action on this legislation. I would be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Questions from the committee? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked earlier Mr. Rogers, I think it was, doesn't this negatively impact or doesn't this contradict the whole idea of allowing the discretionary decision-making of the hospital board in terms of hiring? Wouldn't this be an encroachment upon that by having a prohibition against certain type of offenders?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, it is my reading of this proposal that it would be an absolute ban on any employment or contracting for anyone who is convicted for those sex crimes or for similar sex crimes in other states.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions for the committee? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very
much. Considering the issues that have been raised this morning, I'm not going to proceed into a work session. I'll just close the public hearing and hope that you folks can try to get together and bring this back to us if you can. I think we've isolated what the problems are. There's also an issue of subsequent referral. I checked with counsel. This bill has not been noted for subsequent referral, but perhaps that's an issue. If it comes back, that the full committee would have to deal with if the bill survives work session. So with that, I'll conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2423. Let's see, where am I? Open a public hearing on House Bill 2222. Council will explain the bill, please.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2222 was pre-session filed at the request of the Department of Justice. It gives the DOJ a lien on any judgment or settlement received by a person who is given assistance by the DOJ. and its Crime Victims Assistance Section. This bill replaces ORS 147.355, which gives the DOJ claim on any judgment or settlement. The claim remedy is more difficult to recover because the parties are not required to give DOJ notice, and the DOJ must commence a legal action to recover on these claims, whereas a lien would be automatic.
Thank you. Be mindful, we must adjourn somewhat after 10:30 this morning for a House session, so I know that you'll be coming back if you talked about some amendments, but nonetheless, you may proceed.
Chair Ackerman, committee members, my name is Jason Barber. I'm the Assistant Director for the Crime Victims Assistance Section here in support of House Bill 2222. The Crime Victim Compensation Program processes over 5,500 applications per year, pays out approximately $3.3 million in benefits per year for victims of violent crime in Oregon. As part of that application process, victims agree to pay back their claim costs for any future crime-related recoveries that they may receive as a result of the crime. This usually takes the form of auto insurance, settlements, homeowner policies, and civil judgments. This subrogation agreement prevents double recovery by the victim while maintaining the solvency of the program for future crime victims. Over the past several years, we've been experiencing some increased difficulties in collecting these types of recoveries. They include not receiving proper notification of the action causing the recovery, our current subrogation claim being ignored by sometimes all parties involved, victims receiving net proceeds directly, which cause our program to have to collect those monies back from the victim, which is very problematic. Sometimes we have to compete against other lien holders. Since we don't actually have a lien, we take a subordinate payment position. And finally, increase manpower and legal fees to negotiate and litigate these problem cases. This bill would fix and address all these problems. It would require that our program be notified of the action. It would allow us to file a lien in order to secure our subrogation claim. It would result in us being paid directly and would reduce legal fees and manpower. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. I think I'll proceed with the other witness, too, and then we'll open it for questions.
Thank you.
And if you could refer to the amendments, I didn't know if you wanted to do that now or later, but we've conferred about that.
Right. Yes, we do have amendments drafted. We'll be turning those into Ledge Council directly after this hearing.
Can you just summarize what they would be just for our...
I think I'm going to...
That's your other witness. Yes. Okay. I'm ahead of myself. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Michael Grant, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice here in favor of House Bill 2222. Seeing as how we're short of time, I'm not going to repeat everything that Jason Barber just said. I would like to make a couple of points in addition to what he said. First of all, this bill does not impose any new monetary obligations upon crime victims. The crime victims are already required to repay the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance Section when they receive a double recovery from a third party. What this bill does is allow the Department of Justice to secure its interest in those funds, to be given notice of those funds, and to put it on equal footing with the other lien creditors that are out there. The second point that I'd like to make is that the monies that the Crime Victims Assistance Section recovers, whether it be from a criminal defendant or, in these cases, a double recovery that the victim receives, these monies go dollar for dollar back into the criminal injuries compensation account, where they are used to provide compensation to other crime victims in the state of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, you've reference the amendments that we've prepared. There are several amendments. They are attached to my written testimony that I have submitted. A lot of them are more stylistic. I think there's three that are substantive. The first is, Mr. Chairman, I understand you had a concern about the priority of the attorney fee lien, and so there is a provision in the amendments to clarify that the attorney fee lien on any judgment or settlement would be paid first. The second substantive amendment that we are seeking to the House Bill 2222 is to require notification to the victim and to any party that would be bound by a judgment or a settlement, just universal notification for everybody. The third one I put in there, we have there is a choice of venue provision. Under the existing 147.355, venue is put in Marion County for those actions. This bill would replace 147.355. The Crime Victims Assistance Section is given the discretion to bring the suit in Marion County, as the law presently states, or to go to the county where the victim or the defendant is located at.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, I thank you for your testimony, and look forward to having the amendments, and perhaps next time you can give us maybe a simple hypothetical so we can see the flow of funds through a typical case.
Certainly.
Particularly when there's not enough money to go around, you have to talk about priorities of lien holders and priority of payments. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I will conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2222.
Thank you.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2306. Mr. Markey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Chair Krieger. House Bill 2306 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association, and it makes unmarried parents of a child equally liable for expenses of the education of the child, expenses and the education of the child. Under current Oregon law, ORS 108.040, which is referred to by those who use it as the family expense statute, currently makes a husband and wife who are married equally liable for the expenses of the family and the expenses and education of the children while they are living together. What this means is that if their child perhaps gets sick and goes to the hospital and mom takes the child to the hospital and signs all of the papers to admit the child and be responsible for those expenses, the hospital, if the bill is not paid or remains unpaid, the hospital in that case could go after the mother or the father, the husband or the wife in this case, and they're equally responsible. They could be, either one could be sued, or they could be sued together under the Family Expense Statute 108.040. However, if a couple lived together without the benefit of marriage, and had a child together, and that child got sick, and mom took him to the hospital, and signed all of the papers, same scenario, but in this case they're not married, the hospital could only collect the debt from the mother. The father would simply not be liable under 108.040, and there are several cases that speak to that point. This bill would make unmarried parents who live together responsible equally as they would be if they were married. Now, under 108.040, upon separation of a married couple, the married couple continue to be equally responsible only for those debts incurred for the maintenance, support, and education of the child, which is somewhat narrower. And we've used the same language for unmarried parents in this case. So we believe this to be a good policy for the state of Oregon. We think that all parents should be held to the same standard.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Garrard.
Mr. Markey, if this were a law, is the liability based on the two individuals individual ability to pay, or what you said is equally, which means if you had a father who was working and a mother who wasn't, they both still would be assessed 50% of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gregg, it's not a percentage. It is that they are both responsible for the debt. And under the Family Expense Statute 108040, either can be sued for the whole amount or both can be sued jointly for the whole amount. And this would apply that same standard to unmarried parents. So it's not a one is each is responsible for 50%. That's not the way the Family Expense Statute works. It would be just the liability under the Family Expense Statute would be the same type of liability as if both signed a contract for a TV set. The Circuit City or wherever they bought it could sue either or both for the full amount because they're both liable for the full amount.
Well, there's that old adage that it doesn't do you any good to see somebody who doesn't have any money.
That's, Mr. Chair, Representative Gregg, you're exactly right, and that's where creditors' decisions come into play, and creditors normally don't sue people that don't have any assets or can't pay. So therein lies why the Family Expense Statute applies.
Further questions? Follow-up?
So there is equality in the bill in that both are responsible for the bill,
mm-hmm.
But there is not an equality as far as ability to pay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gregg, that's correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Markey, the term that's both in the married couple statute 108040, and then you've carried over the same language here, refers to the parents being maybe sued jointly or separately.
Yes.
Now the terminology that I'm familiar with from legal training is jointly and severally, and I understand from your prior response that you take separately and severally to mean the same thing, that is, each party can be sued for the full amount of the obligation.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, you're exactly right. And I believe that the cases on, there are a lot of cases on the Family Expense Statute dating back to, because married parents, married husbands and wives are not only equally responsible for the debts of the child, but also for family expenses. And I read a case about where the court was arguing whether a horse and buggy was actually a needed family expense. So there's lots of case law on this, and I think that you would find that the two terms are used interchangeably.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question. I don't have the bill right in front of me. But is it, what if these parents are not living together? Is there a restriction on a standard amount of time they have to be living together, and how's that defined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, that's a good question. And the Family Expense Statute has a whole piece in it about separated husbands and wives, and we've used that same language in this bill to deal with unmarried folks. And what it specifically says is that upon a separation, and there's a whole series of things that the judge should consider in determining whether or not there is a bona fide separation, including whether the parents subsequently reconciled or the number of separations and the length of time they've lived apart, all of those kinds of things. So the judge gets to decide, are you really separated? And then if you are separated, the parents are only equally responsible after separation for expenses or debts incurred for the maintenance, support, and education of the child. And what I believe that is a narrower set of standards than is contained in the expenses of the child and the education of the child that's in when they're married. And what I believe it means is, and has been interpreted, I believe, under the family expense statute to mean, is that, let's say you've got two people, married or unmarried, and they're separated for a long time, maybe divorced. And maybe the child turns 16 and the non-custodial parent goes out and buys the kid a Maserati. That's not a debt and then doesn't pay for it. The custodial parent, I believe, wouldn't be responsible to pay for the Maserati because it's not for the support, maintenance, or education of the child. It's not a necessary expense. I think that's the standard here. Does that answer your question, Representative Worth?
I've got kind of a follow-up. I guess how I read this is I think it's saying that you're, as parents, whether you're separated and when you're separated, you're still liable, both of you are liable for the cost of raising that child. The limiting to the education and maintenance, I think that's just saying that you're not liable for each other's debts. Say as the Maserati, I as the custodial parent would not, because we are separated, I would not be liable for his failure to pay for the Maserati for the child. Right. So what I'm interested in those, you know, you're two people are parents, whether they live together or not, is the fact that they have the child. So what aspect of the actual, you know, sharing a domicile have to do with if we're gonna extend liability or responsibility to parents who are unmarried, what component is the fact that they share a domicile or they don't share a domicile? How does that play into it? I mean, are they not liable if they're unmarried, have a kid, but don't live together?
Two standards, Mr. Chair, Representative Worth. For people who are married, husbands and wives, they are equally responsible for the expenses of the family and the expenses and education of the child. Mm-hmm. Expenses of the family can be, for married people, buying a couch.
Mm-hmm.
If one of them signs for the couch and the other one doesn't, they're both on the hook to pay for the couch,
mm-hmm.
okay, or the TV or whatever it is, expenses of the family. So that standard relates to married people. And once they separate, they are no longer responsible for family expenses because they're not living together as a family. And their liability, equal liability with respect to the children, is limited to the support, maintenance, and education of the child. Pure and simple. Not just any expense, but those expenses related directly to the support, maintenance, and education of the child. Now, you can get into court and argue about was it really that, but it is a more limited responsibility than if they were living together, they'd be responsible for all those expenses.
Right.
What we did in this bill is to say the unmarried parents are always are same standard if they live together, expenses and education of the child when they're separated, limited to support, maintenance, and education of the child. We did not make unmarried people who live together equally responsible for family expenses as they would if they were married. We decided that we shouldn't try to do that.
We're not talking about then. This bill does not then pertain to people who have had a child together but never shared a domicile, and who no longer and who don't live together now. But you know, parented a child but never lived together.
I don't believe so. Mr. Chair,
thank you, Counsel.
I think it would apply to parents that never lived together and had a child together. That's just my reading. I look at subsection 2 of section 2. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I think counsel is right. I believe, but only with respect to that section dealing with the support, maintenance, and education of the child,
okay.
Not general expenses.
Right.
So, all right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was concerned about.
Fine. Thank you. Further questions for the committee? Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification and in light of what Mr. Sears just said, this bill then does reach to those who have created children and have never lived together, and it makes them, holds them responsible for the education and expenses of the child.
For the support, maintenance, and education of the child. A slight distinction, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, but not responsible probably for general expenses of the child, whatever they are. Those expenses must be directly related to the support, maintenance, or education of the child.
Thank you.
All right? Now, one other thing that I need to cover in this bill, and I know you're late, but there is another section in this bill, and I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention it to you. 109.1.1.12, a current statute, says that when a minor child becomes a parent, has a baby, or is the father of a baby, they are no longer a minor. They are automatically of majority. And that's fine. And then the statute goes on to say they can give authorizations. And this statute was created so that if a 16-year-old has a baby, she can sign for treatments or authorizations or releases or waivers for the baby, and probably should be allowed to do that, and that's fine. But the court cases have now said that, I'll give you an example. Mom, a 16-year-old girl gets pregnant and decides to keep the baby with the support of her parents. And she and the parents say, have the baby, live at home, we want to take care of you and help you through this. And as soon as she has the baby, she is of majority, and her parents, the parents of the 16-year-old, are no longer liable for debts incurred for her under the family expense statute. And we don't believe that was ever the intent of the law, and so we've said, notwithstanding 109.1.1.12, that the parents continue to be responsible for their minor children until they reach the age of 18.
Now you provoked a question. Representative Worth.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't that then extend liability to the grandparents for the grandchild?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, specifically not. No. Not to the grandchild. Only to as to the 16-year-old. The grandparents, the family expense statute simply does not cover grandparents. We researched that pretty thoroughly. They have no responsibility with respect to the baby.
But follow up, Mr. Chair. If you're saying the parents are still liable for the minor parents.
Yes.
Liable for that, mm-hmm. for that minor child. Mm-hmm. Even though she has another child. I mean, isn't the child of the minor an expense that then becomes a liability of the grandparents? If the grandparents are liable, or the parents are liable for that minor child, then anything that she incurs, a child, the expenses of a child, wouldn't that then extend?
The Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Worth, the liability would extend to debts incurred by the 16-year-old,
right.
Whatever they were for.
And what if the 16-year-old incurred debts because of the 3-year-old, her 3-year-old?
Chair, Representative Worth, I believe they would be liable for that. Yes, okay. In that instance, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Further questions? There's no other witnesses before us, therefore I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2306 and open a work session on House Bill 2306. Questions, discussion, motion?
Well,
Representative Worth.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess that's a question I have that doesn't leap out at me when I read the bill, but I think that that's taking a huge step in that if you're changing a minor parent that under the law now would no longer be a minor and remains a minor, I think that you are then extending liability to to grandparents in some sense, because if a minor child remains a minor after having a baby under this bill and incurs debts because of that child, and her parents are liable for all of her debts, then I think that just extends, which I'm not opposed to, I guess, but I mean, I just think that this is a huge aspect of this bill that I haven't thought through. Well, I think it extends the liability, though, to grandparents for a grandchild.
Let me make this suggestion that we refer the bill to the full committee to do pass recommendation, and then perhaps Mr. Marquis can give us some more information on Representative Ward's question. We can have that discussion before the full committee. Would that be acceptable?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Girard.
I was supporting the bill until I heard Section 3, Paragraph 2. So I would also join Representative Worth in voting nay.
I didn't hear the last part. You joined Representative Worth in?
In voting nay.
Okay.
On this bill.
At this time?
Yes.
Okay. Further discussion from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I think that maybe a key question here is that point about what the obligation of the grandparent is to the grandchildren's expenses. And if I'm understanding the concerns expressed by my colleagues, that seems to be the sticking point. And I wanted to get a fix on that, whether if it were not obligating the grandparents for the grandchildren's expenses, but only the expenses of the middle generation, would that be alleviate the concerns?
Yeah, I guess I don't see how you can keep it, you know, retain it to the middle child's expenses, because as a parent, you're liable for your offspring's, you know, expenses, and if it becomes my expense as the middle child, then it becomes then under this bill the liability of my parents, which, you know, my parents, thank God, they are liable for my kids', you know, expenses. But I'm not saying whether it's a good idea or not. I just think that that's a huge question and something we don't do right now. We don't extend liability to.
Council, do you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
let me have Council make a suggestion.
Oh, sorry.
I guess I'm not convinced that grandparents would be liable. It's something I could look at the case law. I wanted to ask Mr. Marquis if he knows, because this also is going to cover married parents, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So this last subsection will apply to both married parents and unmarried parents if this bill passes. And I don't know that the term support of the family is going to include, I haven't done the research on that, and I could look at that and see what the extensive case law that Mr. Marquis is talking about says regarding both the standards when the parents are separated and when they're together, to see if debts for their grandchildren would be covered under this subsection.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Flores.
Is it the intention of the bill to extend the those particular responsibilities to the grandparents?
Mr. Marquis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, we believed that the bill limited specifically the parents' liability to the 16-year-old and didn't extend it beyond that, because the statute says family expenses and the expenses and education of the child being the 16-year-old. So I guess our intent certainly was not to extend the liability beyond that and to make the grandparents, in essence, responsible for the child. But Representative Worth has raised a valid point, and I think that it may be unclear. And I guess I would want to make it clear.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, the representative.
Considering the information that we had received from the Court of Appeals, I think it might be helpful if we have some clarity in regard to how this would then extend if we were to pass it this way and not leave it in a state of ambiguity.
That would be in a floor speech, not testimony from a lobbyist, right?
Yeah.
As I recall.
Hello. Mr. Chair, can I?
And I just want to resolve this procedurally so we get on the floor. We could continue the work session and invite Mr. Marquis back to provide us information on this particular issue and then go from there. Would that be the consensus of the that committee so we can move ahead?
And with the benefit of Mr. Sears' research.
Excuse me?
And with the benefit of Mr. Sears' research as well.
Yes, of course.
And can I ask one more thing of Mr. Sears? There's got to be a reason why the statute is the way it is now, and making a minor child parent and no longer a minor. So,
I would imagine that rule was put in so that minor parents, when they have children, can do things such as sign contracts.
Okay.
I'm sure there's other. That's the one that most readily comes to my mind. If right now a minor cannot be held liable for a contract, well, if you're a parent, you're going to be signing all sorts of contracts, I would think, at the hospital when you're having your baby and things like that.
Okay.
So that would be the purpose of that statute. I'm sure there's other reasons.
And if you could find out if that, in fact, the way it's written now, if it absolutely does keep the liability from going beyond the minor parent. But basically the question I have is, my expenses as a 16-year-old are a lot different as a 16-year-old as opposed to a 16-year-old mother. So the expenses that incur as a 16-year-old mother,
Let me move this on. You can confer with counsel about your issue. And I'm going to, the chair will move then that the work session be continued to a date to be determined. And we invite Mr. Marquis back with some information on this issue and hear a special report from Counsel Spears.
Thank you, Mr.
Any objection? So order. Further business of the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.
I think it's